C.S. Lewis was awesome. Now let's bring Elevate back. Was that not incredible? I'm done. Easy crowd. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a hint as to what will happen on March 11. In 2008, I went to Oxford and Cambridge with the C.S. Lewis Foundation, my first trip over there. And while I was there, I met a man who I had had a correspondence with. His name was Derek Brewer. He was a famous Chaucer scholar and a former student, actually, of C.S. Lewis. He was in his 80s, and within a few months of my visit to him with him, he passed away. He had a wheelchair and this big elevator coming down, and when he came down to visit, he roared out, "Descending like Jove from the clouds." A very sweet man. He actually sent me in from Cambridge a copy of a book from Lewis's own library with Lewis's writing all over it. And there's a collection of stories about Lewis, and he writes about C.S. Lewis as a tutor, as a teacher. And Derek recounts his first day going up the steps at Magdalen College to have his tutorial with Lewis. Could you imagine reading your 10-page paper that you wrote every week, a new 10-page paper, and reading it to C.S. Lewis? Knocked on the door flung open, and there stands J.R.R. Tolkien, who says, "Well, Lewis is your tutor then. You'll never get to the bottom of him." And it's true. I think there are really, for me, there's one great reason that Lewis is my master. And it's found in 1 Corinthians. It's chapter 11, verse 1. Paul says, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." And part of the function of the great cloud of witnesses, part of why Paul says, "What you have heard from me, entrust to faithful men," part of what I do every day with, you know, 14 and 15-year-old freshmen who really don't want to read Romeo and Juliet, we take the light that's been given to us, sometimes even thrust upon us, and we do our best to replicate that, to pass that along. You probably know the story of how the secret code of the Roman Christians who would draw half of a fish in the sand with their foot, and if somebody else drew the other half of the fish, they knew that they were of the believers. Christianity isn't inherited. It's what C.S. Lewis calls a good infection. It passes on, and it passes on from person to person. Thanks to the age in which we live, where the printing press and all sorts of permutations of that, now mostly electronic, I can enter into the lives of people who passed away long before I was ever born. And in this way, C.S. Lewis became for me a master. I was traveling with Phil Keggy, the guitar player, in Nashville, Tennessee, and kind of jaded about evangelicalism, and it seemed about as shallow as a thimble to me. I'm sure that that shallowness was not evangelicalism. It was my own shallowness projected upon the world. And I thought, you know, unless there's more to the faith than this, I'm going to sleep in on Sunday and make up my own morality. Phil handed me a copy of Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life. It's C.S. Lewis's spiritual autobiography, where he talks about how he became the most reluctant and dejected convert in all of England. I soon found in Lewis somebody who had thought through his atheism better than I'd ever thought through my faith. And as I began to try to, if not get to the bottom of him, but at least plumb the depths, I found for myself a master. I had read his works as a non-believing young man, as a boy, and I like to say that when I was a child, he sparked my imaginative life, but when I became a man, C.S. Lewis saved my intellectual life. He taught me how to think. He taught me how to believe, and then he taught me what to do with it. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. And so the question that I want to pose, and then maybe take a quick stab at answering when I come back on March 11, is what makes C.S. Lewis so imitable? Why are we still talking about him now and not so many others of his contemporaries? I think that there are two things. I think it has to do with his ability and his humility. Now, I apologize to Pastor Greg for not giving 3 points nor alliterating them. It's been a while since I've been a good Baptist. I still remember. His ability and his humility are, I think, the things worth replicating, worth reproducing in my own lives and in the lives of anybody I can pin to the ground and shove a copy of Narnia into their hands. So I'm going to tell you two stories. Pastor Doug said tell stories. I've got two. The first goes like this. It's an audience participation story, okay? C.S. Lewis would teach Anglo-Saxon. This is Beowulf language. How many of you had to read that terrible, awful poem in high school? How many of you hated it terribly? Oh, I'll teach you how to enjoy it. It's a great poem. J.R.R. Tolkien actually turned the corner on Beowulf criticism. He says, you don't read it because it's this historical document about Scandinavia. There's only two reasons to read it. It's a poem, and poems are awesome, and it's about monsters. And monsters are awesome. The whole critical world basically since then said, oh, it's a poem about monsters. Lewis would teach this poem and teach it in Anglo-Saxon. And to help his students, he would invite them up to his rooms in Magdalen. And in Oxford, they give you a set of rooms, a sitting room and a kitchen and a bedroom. And he would have a keg of warm, flat English beer there and serve his students a pint of beer, and they would proceed to try and translate Anglo-Saxon. After a couple of pints, which is a lot for a Baptist, but not much for an Englishman, or an Irishman, as actually Lewis was. In fact, one day, Lewis and Tolkien were at the pub, and after 3 pints of beer, Lewis got up to leave, and it was early spring, and Tolkien said, well, where are you going? He said, it's Lent. I'm going short. let's just say, after a little refreshment in Lewis's rooms while reading Beowulf, Lewis would sometimes get this twinkle in his eye, and he would challenge his students. He would say, he would kind of toss out there, and here's the audience participation part. Ready? Pick a number, someone between 1 and 40. 37, I heard. Okay, 37. Go to the 37th bookcase there in his room. Pick a number now between 1 and 5, this side of the room. Go to the third shelf, Lewis would say. Now, pick a number between 1 and 20 in the middle.
11.
Great. Go to book 11. Open it to, pick a number between 1 and 200.
130.
Page 130. Now, pick a number between 1 and 35. Read line 10 from page?
130.
From book 11 on shelf in bookcase 37, and the student would read the line, and Lewis would proceed to quote the entire page. He read everything. Austin scholar Joel Heck records that at his height, Lewis was reading a full book every 2 or 3 days. It was like chunking paperbacks into a big bonfire. He swallowed books whole. He read everything, and he remembered everything he ever read. A student once said, certainly not everything. They were sitting at dinner at Oxford, and Lewis said, well, yes. The student said, well, what about Lydgate's Medea? You've read Lydgate, right? The 12th century English monk and his, you know, me either. His version of the ancient Greek play Medea. And Lewis said, well, start me with a line. And so the student trundles off to the Oxford Union, to the library, and brings back a copy of Lydgate's Medea and opens it up and reads a line, and Lewis quotes the rest of the act. He read everything. And for half of his life, he was an atheist. And so he read everything he could get his hands on to get away from Christianity, but the hound hound of heaven chased him down. And midway through his life, this man who was an Oxford-trained philosopher came begrudgingly to his knees and changed the world. This was a man of exceptional talent. This was a man of his generation. He was the great man on campus. But with such an intellect, he set aside his own ego. And so, in addition to his enormous ability, the thing I think that really sets Lewis aside is his humility. The moment he believed, before he believed in Christ, but after he believed in God, he began going to church, and it caused a scandal. He said, "Well, I thought one should fly one's flag." Quoting Kipling, he said, "If I could play tambourine with my toes on a street corner and save one more soul, I would do it." Well, he didn't play any tambourines, but he lost a number of jobs. You see, he was up for professorships, a job of great prestige in the Oxford-Cambridge system, and three times he lost, usually because, according to his detractors, he was the author of the Screwtape Letters. You see, in Oxford, you don't publish outside your field. And Lewis was publishing popular theology. Lewis very deliberately set aside his dignity and, I believe, his professional career in order to defend the faith, knowing that it would cost him. And it did. And it did. And it did. This is a man who hated to be interrupted. Lewis's secretary, Walter Hooper, is in his 80s. He lives in Oxford and very graciously invites me over to tea at his flat every time I go. And I try to send Walter to the kitchen for more tea while I steal Lewis's own original. No, I shouldn't do that. Walter tells me that Lewis would spend the first 2 hours of every day pushing pen across paper. You see, once he became a popular figure in Christianity, people began to write him for help and advice and wisdom and to read a draft of their poetry or for money or marriage proposals. Lewis was a man, you see, who hated interruption. But he set aside his own agenda for the cream of the morning. He loved what he called the small, dewy, cobwebby hours of the morning. I don't relate. I'm a morning person between midnight and 2 a.m. But there's Lewis sacrificing the best of his day and maybe several books that he could have written. But now we have 3,800 pages, 50,000 letters. He answered every letter he ever received. I was privileged last summer by the C.S. Lewis Foundation, who produced this video, to stay in the kilns in Lewis's home. I got to cook a curry for the neighbors, and I got to stay in Lewis's bedroom. Yes, there's a wardrobe there. No, obviously, I didn't get in. It's the narrowest room in the house. Lewis set himself aside. He humbled himself. He treasured his dogs and his cats. Once his cat, old Tom, had lost his teeth, Walter Hooper tells me, he made his housekeeper, Mrs. Miller, cook fish without any bones. Now, a pensioner is, in England, it's somebody who's been in the service, in the military, and then the government takes care of you after you've left your job and retired. So Walter tells me that he was walking down Kiln Lane with Lewis one day and saw old toothless Tom on the fence, and Lewis nudged Walter and said, "Pensioner," and fed him fish that Tom could gum, you know, to death until Tom passed. Cambridge finally made him a professor, and that tripled his salary, doubled his prestige, and cut his workload in half. They brought him in for some of their critical fights, and so We'll get to this last story, and then I'll leave you alone. There's much better things upstairs than what you have here. This last quote, he was brought in to have these kind of famous fights, and he was a very popular lecturer in England. Derek Brewer told me you could always tell where Lewis was lecturing. The bicycles were piled 3 and 4 deep outside the lecture hall. In a booming voice, he said he would come in, unwrapping his scarf even as he started the lecture, and then with no notes, lecture for an hour, and then wrap up his scarf and pithily drop the mic, you know, pithily hit that last apostrophe sentence at the end and walk out. Very popular lecturer. Do we have that last quote? He says in one of his letters, "My lectures here at Cambridge have never been more poorly attended. My journey here to Cambridge has become an estimable flop. It must be frightfully good for me." This immensely popular academic who goes and loses a critical battle, even as someday he would win the critical war, takes this drop in popularity as a good gift from a loving God. Let yourself go. Let go of that grudge. Let go of that irritation. Let yourself go and find your... Well, let me close and have Lewis tell us better. This is how he ends Mere Christianity. "This principle runs through all life from top to bottom. Give up yourself, and you will find your real self. Lose your life, and you will save it. Submit to death, death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, and death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself, and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ, and you will find him, and with him, everything else thrown in. You have laid before you in this next 6 weeks upstairs, everything else thrown in. But as you climb those stairs to explore those options, set yourself aside. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, for he will lift you up." Thank you for the brief moment to speak with you. I'll see you again in March.